He hails from Canada, from the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies at Concordia University, and he helped build up the Digital Mass Atrocity Prevention Lab. Please welcome Nikolai.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. Thank you all for just coming at to the latest talk tonight. And thank you for CCC for inviting us. It's a great honor for us to be here. Just a little bit about myself, just a little bit of background. Like I'm a German Swiss citizen, but I work now in Montreal for the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies. And since the beginning of the year, since April, I helped build up what we call the Digital Mass Atrocity Prevention Lab. And I mean, everyone has a lab these days. And so what we want to do with that is actually kind of try and reach out into different communities. Like, we do a lot of policy work, but obviously, like, since we have like a hacking audience tonight, like, we also want to be involved in like tech communities and the hacking communities. So when we saw the talk on the keynote and then the introduction on to this Congress, like, my colleagues and I were really pleased to see that there is a need from the community actually to open up and kind of let people who are not necessarily hackers, like, my background is international relations and not necessarily the deep tech. I'm interested in it, and like, I follow what the CCC is doing for the last couple of years. And especially one talk just at the camp this year by Claudio about helping the helpless, where he basically told the InfoSec community to reach out to human rights groups and help them where they can actually be helpful. That resonated with us, and we come from the other side. And basically, in Montreal, like, we're a fairly small team. And so what I'm going to talk about in the next couple of, 20 minutes, is just a little bit what we did over like the last 7, 8, 9 months. And it's going to be like pretty much in chronological order. We're going to talk a little bit about what the UN is doing in peacekeeping and peace tech. We did a big research project using Media Cloud. That's a tool by the Berkman Center and the MIT Center for Civic Media. We kind of encouraged, like, we talked to a lot of technologists and hackers at various hackathons, and so we kind of want to share some lessons learned. And like, if there's time, I just want to go through like a couple of various projects which we found a little bit interesting, very interesting, and just kind of see what you could learn from it, and like, just open the dialogue between different fields, because obviously I'm coming from a fairly different field than many of you. So one thing we do at the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies, we have a workshop on mass atrocity prevention. So it's mainly for policymakers and people in the peace keeping and peace building community. A lot of people with a non-technical background. And what we try to do in the last couple of years is getting more tech stuff into the workshops. You see here this picture, that's like the workshop in the middle. We have Walter Dorn, who is a professor in Kingston, Ontario, in Canada. And he looks on how like the UN is using technology, or could be potentially using technology, to monitor peace treaties, or just kind of look at new ways, because I mean, obviously it's 2015 and the UN is finally kind of catching up to that. For those who are interested, like, there is, earlier this year, like, the UN actually came out with a final report on how they can use new technologies in peacekeeping. And Walter Dorn was part of that kind of expert panel. So there are things happening. I mean, the UN is a slow and sometimes very kind of hard to maneuver. So it's interesting to see that even there's kind of thinking about technology and admittedly, like, it is more like on the military side of things. So like they think about like the new peacekeeping kind of force and how to kind of get them equipped. But what we also have been involved with is like a growing field of what they call peace tech, which is more like on the civil side, and really kind of, I believe a lot of people with good intentions are being part of that. And like, it seems like there are a couple of conferences out there since, I guess, 2010, 2011, they started, and what they want to do is try to get a lot of people from the hacking community, software development community together with peace building community. So it's about kind of getting the barriers down between different different fields. Because that's also what we saw over like pretty much last year in the different events we participated in. Like, it is difficult for those fields to talk to each other. There's different languages, different backgrounds, and like different cultures. And we see a benefit in actually in kind of getting those barriers down in a bit. So that would be one part of just kind of informing you what's out there. There's way more stuff out there. And that's just like a brief overview. The other thing what we did is at the Montreal Institute, we have a media monitoring project where basically we do qualitative research in countries which might be at risk of mass atrocity or atrocity crimes. There are other NGOs out there. The Crisis Group, for example, has a very prominent project as well. But what we find is that it's very difficult to just kind of, we basically rely on interns who like scape, look at the media landscapes in those countries and look at international media and then see what's actually happening. But it's very qualitative work. So we were thrilled when we saw that there is a way to actually use more quantitative methods. There's a tweet by Ethan Zuckerman, which we basically followed. We wrote a proposal for this, and we kindly got invited to do research with the Media Lab. What we did there was we used the Media Cloud framework. They have a couple of other tools. We mainly used the Media Metro dashboard, which pretty much is like a dashboard which you can query a database in the sense that we queried the database about U.S. mainstream media. There's about 25 biggest media sources in the U.S. And basically just look, you can query for different subjects, and then it gives you like a timeline where you see like it's basically sentences per day, and then over the timeline which you have looked at, and you can get like a world cloud. And then it's very good to kind of just get a very brief overview on a topic. And what we did, we were really interested in a lot of countries we did research on, like in sub-Saharan Africa mainly. So we wanted to know how sub-Saharan Africa is presented in US mainstream media, because many of the things you would normally think is like, there are a couple of topics which always come up, but many other good things which happen in sub-Saharan African countries, they never show up. So what you see here, we have a couple of countries like Cameroon, Niger, South Sudan, Uganda. They're all plotted next to each other. And what we found is that compared to other topics, there's not much coverage at all, if there is. And if there's actually interest, you see it here, it's when there's a World Cup. So there's like an event in the West, which then actually sparks interest in media attention. And obviously now we don't really have too much to compare it to, so we figured that like we needed something which is very prominent in US mainstream media, and that is Kim Kardashian. I'm not sure if you know who she is. She's like a media celebrity. But when you plot it against like what the media attention she gets is way more than what all those nine sub-Saharan African countries get combined. That's actually not nothing new. We had that kind of research that's been done like since the 60s, but now we can actually show it on like with actual like a lot of data behind it. Then we also went into like a more like a qualitative sort of research where we looked at 50 articles each, and what we saw was like basically we have like 340 stories which are valid, and when you look at what the frame of those stories is, it was terror-related, it's Ebola-related, or soccer-related. That's pretty much the main topics you get on mainstream media reporting in Africa is that. And so a lot of good things which are happening in those countries are not getting reported. They're just not there. So when we kind of were at that stage, we looked at the supply side of things. That's what the media supplies, and that's what people can read and all. And we also looked at the same time when we did the research. There was an article by Quinn Norton on Medium where she basically says that it's also on the demand side. Like, so a lot of people actually don't really want to like read anything else. So she has a very strong quote there, where she says, like, you people never click the fucking link. And when we kind of think about mass atrocity prevention or prevention of atrocities, we believe it's important to know that the way we see a lot of countries, like African countries especially, we need another frame. We just don't need only the frame we have, which gets normally portrayed, like Ebola and terror related. Then one thing we kind of did at the same time when we talked about when we did the research, when we wrote the proposal right at the beginning, we had like a little mishap. I'm really interested in like the philosophy track we have here at the Congress, and so I want to share like the it's like a little anecdote. So basically, what happened? We saw the proposal, and I went. I just saw it on my work computer, and then I went home on my laptop, and so I went home and wrote like an email, just kind of trying to figure out, hey guys, what is that research about, etc. And just had a couple of questions. What I didn't know was that my wife actually installed a Chromium plugin, which would actually mock the overuse of the word cloud and turn it into butt. So what happened, I read this really long, elaborate email because I think that it was a great project, and then this is what I get back. FYI, it's media cloud, not media butt. I'm really curious, et cetera. Obviously, it was a fail. We felt embarrassed, but we were lucky and we got it. But like, yeah, I think it's important to kind of share whatever mishaps you have, be it in like software development or especially in academia. So just putting it out there very briefly. Then I guess the last thing I want to talk about is like we participate in various hackathons, and there were sometimes free and open source software hackers there. There was a lot of people work from just like the traditional tech community. Like in Montreal, we have a lot of software developers. And obviously out there, there's like some sort of like a hackathon fatigue. I mean, you see there like T-Mobile and Red Bull and Evernote, they're like basically big corporations using hackathons and hacking culture in a way to basically outsource their R&D. So we also saw kind of like a hackathon fatigue in what we did, and we had like a couple of criticisms. Like pretty much the biggest thing we noticed was that when like a lot of people who organized hackathons we participated in, they tried to bring actually both pieces together, the tech community and then the peace-building community, for example. But oftentimes, it was really difficult to actually get enough people with the tech knowledge. So you had like 40, 50 people, but only two or three were able to code. Which then in the end, if you have to actually like try to get some sort of ideas going and a deployable project, you actually end up with a lot of policy talk and a lot of like there wasn't as much like cross-culturization as like and then talking between the fields as I would have kind of hoped for it. But also like I would say more like on the positive side of things, an example was where we participated in like the Talking Peace Festival, where we found like they had a hackathon in Washington D.C. and we participated in that, and there we found a good mix of both people actually knew how to code, knew kind of how to think about surveillance and kind of think about the important topics I guess the audience here is really concerned about. And what we also found is that when you think about building whatever kind of technology, it's really important to be engaged with the community, those people it should be served with or for. So we found like this was something we felt like there was a lot of movement. I think there was interest from both sides. So it wasn't only from like the political policy side, but also from the side of the tech knowledge. And we think, and so like in a way, we like what a lot of NGOs and human rights groups could use like hackathons or similar ideas could use it for is actually like, yeah, build trying to get a bridge between those two communities. I know there's like, I mean, today we heard a lot of fairly depressing stories, and I don't want to end with like a happy ending, but like I'm just like what I want to say is that we feel that there is like there are a lot of people who think they could be working together to actually build technologies which could help people in human rights situations, and what we think in Montreal is actually just trying to engage and get together and see where that leads. That's part of why I'm here. That's kind of like I'd be happy to talk to people who like have different thoughts and actually give us feedback on what we can improve, because if it is about talking to each other, that's something we would really be engaging in. Okay, and so like just to give you like an example of a couple of projects we found fairly interesting or kind of we came across during the time we did the research and in the last half year. There's a project called the early warning system, which basically has a couple of components. It has like a statistical analysis method and some sort of like an expert crowdsource. So they ask a lot of people from the peacebuilding community and different other communities, like what they're gonna think is gonna happen in the next 12 months in country X, Y, Z, and then they give opinions. Like it's a fairly big opinion poll too. It's about like I think 200 people participating from different fields. So it kind of tries to get a couple of methods together, and I'm very sure that like a lot of people who are engaged with this project would be interested in how to make those tools better, because what we kind of think is that a lot of NGOs and human rights groups, what they can offer is kind of like a network to connect people with each other, and they also have like a oftentimes quite a better knowledge of how to actually get the message out, rather than if you just have technologists and attackers who just think about the deep tech and that's what they're doing. And so like kind of getting their heads away from the keyboard and actually in the wider world and how it is deployed, et cetera. So it'd be great if we could get some feedback on that as well. Then there's another, actually like, I'm a very kind of hesitant to promote apps because I'm not really sure how just an app by itself can promote peacekeeping or mass atrocity prevention. It's just, I don't really see that's necessarily like a good way of promoting it. But there's this one app we found pretty interesting. It's called Eyewitness, and basically what it does, it is an app to document atrocity crimes. And like it's you can just download it, and it kind of looks at, takes the security of the people who use it very seriously. So for example, like it's not just like a logo on the app, but it's kind of, it's more hidden in within the OS. But actually to get to that point, it took a lot of work from security researchers to actually be able to make photos of an atrocity and then securely transmit it to, I think it's the International Bar Association, which then can use those pictures with timestamps, et cetera, then to be actual legal documents in, for example, ICT, the International Criminal Court cases. I think the last thing I would do is just kind of, there are like three Canadian companies, I think a couple of them might be even at the Congress. So we try to kind of engage with them, like for example, Equality, Subgraph, and Siphon. They work very much with free and open source software in the field of human rights, and kind of, since we're very new with what we're doing at the Digital Mass Atrocity Prevention Lab, it would be great if we could just kind of get a conversation going, seeing what's actually, what we're doing really badly from a security perspective. And yeah, so if I think that should be actually most of what I wanted to share. I will put a couple of links already of what we did and what we did on an Etherpad. But feel free to just reach out, write your comments in there. You can't even troll. I will just delete it. And yeah, I think that would be the main thing of my talk. Give us feedback and let us know what you think, and then be critical.
Thank you very much, Nikolai. Okay. We have actually plenty of time for questions. So if you have any questions, please line up at the microphones. Are there questions from IRC? No questions from IRC. Any questions from the audience? No? Come on. Please go to the microphone so our listeners at home can hear you and we can also record it. Microphone front left, please.
From left. Hi.
Hey.
Okay. I guess some reflections because you were also asking for input. The first one was that I'm interested if anyone here is developing USSD or SIM application toolkits or any type of technology that I guess it's called technological blending or whatever you call it, but to bridge the digital divide between people with dumb phones and feature phones, which are pretty much the new dumb phone, and I guess, yeah, the entry level of an Android phone that can run that app is always increasingly going down. Successful projects like Ushahidi have thought about that integration with the dumb phones from the start. So I would be interested if we have those skills or SIM application toolkit, for example. Is that a completely neglected technology? That's just, I guess, more of a brain fart, more of an idea. And then the second question is, how do you deal with the fact that in situations like this, you do usually have tech experts, usually from the global north, narrating the stories of the global south? Is a big generalization, but it's a tendency, and how does that get resolved?
Right. Well, I think the second question, like, I could answer in a way that a lot of what we're doing is part of a learning experience, especially for myself personally. Like, I know my colleagues that do that work for a longer time, and like they've been involved in peacebuilding projects for a long time, so they were actually talking about, like, you know, how getting Western narratives, getting them into like sort of like narratives where they kind of shouldn't be. And so they know way more about that. But for us, like, for me personally, it's just kind of like a learning experience. That's why we try to reach out. So I'd be happy to talk more if that's possible later.
Great. Sorry, just to add a selfish point, I'm writing a thesis on the topic. So if anyone wants to continue a conversation later,
sure.
I'm sure that's the point of this whole session anyway. To continue a conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Microphone on the front right, please.
Yeah, thematically bridging the early warning project and the media cloud project, I'm wondering, it seems kind of plausible to me that mass atrocities are introduced by some media activity locally or globally. And I'm wondering if you're aware of any research or if you have done any research into that direction, analyzing media and as an early warning for mass atrocities. Are you aware of any research done in that direction?
Yeah, like, I mean, one piece why we were interested in what Media Cloud is providing is that it actually measures what's happening in the media environment in certain countries, for example, Burundi. One thing we kind of were thinking about, and that's just an idea, which would be interesting to get also some feedback about it. Like, there's something called the CHDL project. It's like the general database on language and tone. And I mean, it's a project with, like, actually Google is behind some of that. And they basically look at media environments in almost real time. So when you basically have an environment where you think there might be atrocities happening in the near future, that could be something to look at because you can actually monitor what's happening. But I mean, then again, monitoring is close to, then again, also, like, you surveil a whole country and you surveil what's happening in their environment. But like, that's something we talked about. Like, I mean, the research on what, like, different technologies or media play in mass atrocities, that's I think that's a whole range of literature out there. When you look at the Rwandan genocide, for example, there's a whole bandwidth of literature on like radio as being the enabling technology because there was there was lies and kind of hate speech transmitted over radio technology, for example. So there is a whole bunch of research on that topic.
The microphone front left, please.
Hi, thanks for the talk.
Thank you. Could
you expand a little bit, like in an ideal world, what kind of software would be missing from a peace building or from a UN perspective?
In an ideal world, like, I mean, if there is such a thing. I think what we're actually interested in is how to enable collaboration. I think collaboration tools might be something really interesting to look at, because you have in some environments you have many different NGOs with different kind of channels and how they work with each other. So if you make it like a community effort, it might be interesting to look at just basic collaboration tools and how to implement them. I mean, from the little insight I got over the work I did over the last couple of months, and over like a year, was that oftentimes the tools are there, and then tools are there to be used, but they're actually not embraced or not used by a lot of NGOs, or like, I mean, when we look at like a lot of surveillance technologies, right, or anti-surveillance technologies, people know about it, but they don't really know how to use it, and it actually would be great to have better resources. I mean, so far there are wikis, and there's a way to implement it, but it also, I think it needs a human factor to actually push people to use the technologies who could be provided in them.
Microphone front right, please.
So I understood that you are covering official media reports with Media Cloud.
Right.
Are you also researching already in the social media, like the publicly available whatever, Twitter streams and stuff like that, to analyze them?
Like, us personally, we don't. I mean, obviously, there is. I've been involved with a couple of projects I know about it, but I said, who do that? But that's the thing, like, us, it's like, we're like a handful of people, actually, at my institute. And, like, we don't, at this point, we don't have the technological skills or the tech skills, and some of it is actually fairly easy, I suppose. I mean, there are tools out there on which you can like look at what's happening on Twitter, et cetera. And actually, like at this hackathon in Washington D.C., we had something which basically looked at this the Cheetah project, Media Cloud, and Twitter at the same time as some sort of like a big monitoring system or risk assessment system. And the interesting thing about Cheetah is it also evaluates tone. So basically, if I have a sentence which is kind of negative towards a special group, it would kind of it could theoretically trigger something, and we had a couple of guys who like coded in Python. They coded like a prototype, and basically they would then send it automatically a message to the peace building people on the ground. So they're thinking about it. Like I'm not really sure who else is thinking about that kind of stuff, but I mean the fact is like the stuff's going to be more digital, like. Years to come, so like, I think the peace building community will have to catch up to that too.
Yeah. I think that Twitter sentiments or also image recognition, this can help. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Microphone front left, please.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. One thing that was missing for me was actions for peace enforcement, which you, I think, did not cover. In the talk, did you?
What are you talking about?
Peace enforcement is the third escalation step for UN atrocity prevention.
What you meaning deploying forces, etc.?
I mean deploy forces to
right.
prevent.
Well, like
stuff. So there. What I saw here was mostly reactive. I mean, right. International law is reactive on these atrocities. I think technology could also be used as an offensive weapon. The eyewitness idea, I think, was a good start. If you combine it, for example, with image recognition on the ground, or let's say drones, or small mini drones that fly over the area affected, so that they are also visible, so that people on the ground who might commit atrocities can also see that they are witnesses.
Right.
Stuff like that, so that you build up offensive capabilities with technology. I think that will also be interesting.
Right, that's something I personally haven't thought about yet, but thanks for the input. That's great.
Do we have any questions from IRC? No? Then one last time, microphone front left, please.
You'd mentioned using technology for looking at the media, and it seemed like also some things were leveraging what's already been done by different organizations involved in preventing atrocities. And it seemed like you thought that Eyewitness was an example of an app that may not be a very effective direction for technology investment. But it seems like the appeal of an app like that is that it's about directly impacting the atrocity, whereas the media and just leveraging other people's abilities seems more indirect. It seems like this image recognition is also a way of using technology to more directly impact things. I kind of wonder if there are other directions that would come to your mind as far as having a direct impact on an atrocity or potential atrocity.
Well, actually, just to correct you, I think what I meant with the apps, in general, I think, like I've seen a lot of apps which just don't really make much sense. It's basically just like a website and an app umbrella, just kind of repackaging content. Actually, the Eyewitness app we found comparatively very, very kind of smart in the way of they thought about it. So what was the other part of your question? Whether we think about other ways of?
Yeah, kind of what we've been talking about so far besides Eyewitness is like image recognition, where it seems like clearly the technology itself is playing an integral role in preventing or documenting an atrocity. So I was wondering if there are other ways that the technology can be used to directly impact either the prevention or the results of an atrocity.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be honest, like I'm not really sure like whether we thought about image recognition in that sense as you describe it. But I mean, that's part of why we're here, because like we kind of want to get input on like a lot of different things. I mean, obviously like you can research a lot, but just getting like a human feedback on things would be is very valuable. So if you can stick around a couple of minutes later, I would be happy to talk more. That's okay.
Thank you very much, Nikolai. Please give him a warm round of applause.